Welcome to another scintillating edition of the Cosmic Weather, but we're not talking about the weather. We're doing a special interview with my friend and colleague and fellow amazing astrologer, Eric Myers, coming to us from Asheville, North Carolina.
Thanks for having me, Kelly.
Yeah, so this is Eric, and we're both born in part of this 1971 Jupiter-Neptune in Sagittarius conjunction, so we're like into this spiritual, philosophical approach to astrology, which takes it beyond the egoic level of, when am I going to fall in love, and what's the answer to my bank account mode to astrology, into, hey, how can you awaken through the spiritual path? And Eric has written a new book called The Astrology of Awakening, Volume 1, Eclipse of the Ego. So in it, he explores many different ramifications of where astrology is going in the 21st century. We're kind of getting together with a bunch of other astrologers and putting together a more transpersonal approach to astrology, but for a new generation. And he talks in the book about various things, basically opening up with talking about what is oneness and unity consciousness and spiritual awakening. And how can we, bring that level of consciousness into astrology so that consciousness evolves? That's the whole focus behind evolutionary astrology, is that things evolve down here. Right, Eric?
Yes, they do. Yeah. Thanks for having me on, Kelly. It's been a while since you and I co-hosted the Cosmic Weather, and it's great to be back, so I really appreciate that.
Yeah, I think mainly because we both have had our progressed moons in the 12th house, we've kind of did a disappearing act.
Yeah, so yeah, sure.
We've both been very inward and working on our books and cranking out books, you know. And so it's good to reconnect and see where we are with each other and with our work. And we're both very passionate about consciousness and the transpersonal dimension of astrology. I was steeped in Dane Rudyard since I was 14, and, you know, reading about the galactic pleroma and taking your place in a more of a galactic consciousness. So I've been thinking about astrology beyond the sun sign horoscope approach to astrology since my inception into the art, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so for me, I was actually enrolled in transpersonal psychology program at Naropa while I was getting into astrology. And so, I was well-versed with Ken Wilber and other types of teachings even before astrology. So it was just very natural for me just to get into it.
Yeah, it's interesting because now I'm back in Boulder and you're in Asheville. We did the switch places thing. And here I am in Boulder. I'm teaching a class called the Tao of Astrology. And a lot of the students that are signing up for the classes are students from Naropa who are in the transpersonal psychology department. So they're getting an acceleration to their studies over there.
Yeah, I miss it. I haven't been back to Boulder since I left in early 2010. So, talking to you brings up some fondness for my previous life.
Yes, yes. It's like talking to a past life, but it's a future life too, because I'm sure you'll come back sooner or later.
Yeah, I'll definitely come back to visit, but it was time to move on, and the lessons that have been opened in Asheville have been very important, and, you know.
Totally.
We're exactly where we need to be.
Exactly. And I was in Asheville, the Village of Ashes. I mean, back in 2002, 2003, I had Pluto crossing my ascendant when I got to Asheville. And so the Village of Ashes, I always thought of it as Pluto, you know, rising from the ashes. And when it was crossing my ascendant, of course, it was opposing my moon in Gemini. And I'm sure you remember that too, because it was probably opposing your Venus. But during that time, I wrote a work called Living the Mystery, The Physics of Consciousness, which I haven't shown to anybody. And when I was reading through your book, I was like, wow, this is awesome. This is exactly where astrology needs to be going, you know, in terms of like bringing in the big picture and how we can actually, on our little picture scale, attune ourselves to that, as opposed to just being in this egoic mindset of, what can it do for me? You know, people are always asking me like, hey, can you predict my future? And I'm like, that's not what it's about. If you think that's what it's about, don't even investigate it. I've gotten to this point of like, you know, grouchy old man about it. Like, dude, there's so much more.
That's a point that I'd like to comment on, because I think, you know, Kelly, this is the principal issue, is this idea of, do we co-create our existence with spirit, Or is everything predictive and we're just going through the motions and we don't have free will? And what is so amazing to me, probably the greatest shock and surprise of my whole professional life, is so many astrologers believe that things are working inside like, you know, like a billiard game. And you can figure everything out through astrology. And it's not my experience at all, nor do I, what I gather from science, from quantum physics. We are involved with, you know, probability fields. Energy is teeming with multiple different ways that it can manifest. And our consciousness is what activates the astrology. And so, so many people are looking at astrology for predictive reasons, which collapses, in my view, how the universe actually works, which everything is a co-creation between your consciousness and the universe. And so my view is that everything is kind of like a dream, is a projection of the ego dream, and you are the architect and the director of your dream. And so you can't look at astrology to tell you what's going to happen in your dream because you co-create it. And the fact that the mainstream paradigm doesn't get this and they're still holding on to this predictive model, which is inaccurate, it's not how the universe works, is baffling to me. Because here's the thing, if everything was predictive, then every astrologer should be a multi-billionaire. And if they're not, then they don't know, what they're doing then. Because if everything was, you know, easily predictive, Jupiter comes to Venus and this is going to be play the lottery, why aren't they all insanely filthy rich? They're not, because that's not the way it works.
Exactly. I totally agree. I mean, to me, astrology has always been a meditation with the cosmos, you know?
Yeah.
And when I sit down and meditate and I visualize floating out there with the planets and their cycles and visualize where they are on my chart, and I visualize how I can... What is the range of probabilities and possibilities that I can express these different diverse energies on the physical, mental, emotional, archetypal, and spiritual unified levels? To me, it's like a spiritual path, you know?
Yeah. And the other thing about it, as you mentioned, there's multi-levels. And things, in my understanding, the more conscious we become, the more subtle a lot of these energies and these transits in your natal chart manifest. It doesn't always operate on tangible, overt levels. You might have certain lessons at work that have to do with other realms of consciousness that you're processing stuff through. It doesn't necessarily mean that you have a certain transit, something's going to happen. Something's definitely going to happen internally. It may happen externally. It may happen in a variety of different ways. But what I believe we're emerging from, and this is part of the paradigm shift, is what I call this means that. Anything in a natal chart or anything in a transit, when you collapse the possibilities and you say that a certain natal configuration or transit or what have you means a particular something, then you are shortcutting the evolutionary possibilities because it's infinite at the archetypal level. There's so many things that things can mean. So many levels, so many dimensions, and so much of astrology limits possibilities by saying, oh, if you got Saturn in the seventh, it means this. You're going to have challenges in relationship or something, you know, very packed kind of description. And there's really infinite possibilities with everything in astrology. And that's, and because of that, it's very difficult to predict what will happen. So my view is that astrology needs to stop denying people the free will to co-create their lives.
Exactly. What I say about that is that when I counsel clients, you know, I tell them right up front, astrology is not about prediction. It's one of my upfront statements. It's not about predicting the future. It's about creating and co-creating the future yourself based on your relationship with the universe and what kind of energies are available to us that the... You know, time wave is flowing in such a way that it's very flexible, and all time isn't the same time. All time has quality. That's what physics misses and science misses, is that the T in the equations has quality, not just quantity, and astrology tracks this quality. And if you can journal your transits and like list all the different possibilities, then you can, you know, get together with, say, a Jupiter-Venus transit and say, hey, instead of falling in love or winning the lottery, maybe I want to go sign up for an art course or, you know, do a different wide range of expression, or maybe just narrow it to one thing and really focus on that, you know, so you actually get to play astrology.
Yes, you get to play your hand. And another point that I want to make about this, if you, and I mentioned this in the book in the opening chapter, is we have to look back at the origin part of it, of astrology's early days. You had the king, you had the court astrologer, and the king wasn't so interested in the evolution of consciousness. The king wanted to know some specifics. When is a good time to attack the other empire? And if the astrologer wasn't very good, then, you know, at times they became executed. So there's a lot of pressure on precision and prediction. That is how the field way back when was used. And so that's the legacy of, well, you know, that's not the whole thing, but that's part of it. And astrology moving from that, moving on from then, you know, that's the way that people approach it. That's the mindset. You know, when's a good time for this? What's going to happen with this event? And so a lot of focus was on seeing how things did manifest and drawing correlations that that's exactly what it meant. But the problem is that you're looking at a very limited one window. You know, the consciousness of that time is interacting with the energy within the context of those civilizations and that way of living. And so to extrapolate that that's how astrology works in 2012, to me, is a mismatch, is that the context, meaning the consciousness that is interacting with the astrology at this time frame, at this level of consciousness, is how it's going to manifest. And so, you know, you're not going to look at things and think it's the time to, you know, launch a war, you know, from another empire. Well, we're not kings. You know, this is the whole point of the Awakening book, is to see the sun as awakening rather than as the empire itself. That's a very egoic view, is that the sun is the king, is who wants to conquer and to have a lot of riches and fame and, you know, just power. And a lot of astrology, in my view, is organized around supporting people being the king rather than awakening from all those ego traps. And that's really what my book is about.
Yeah, the whole American mindset is everybody wants to be the king of their own little hill, you know? And
that's been projected on astrology, and the conventional view is the sun is ego, is to me a perfect reflection of that. And so my view is that the moon has a lot more to do with the ego, and I call it the egoic takeover, because the moon is like a is projected out through our radiance, and it's who we are inside, and then it's projected out in egoic ways. So we see the sun, which is the radiance, the projection, as ego, because it's projecting the ego, which in my view is the moon.
I like the opening section where you talk about that old patriarchal value system and the a farewell to kings. The funny thing is that in astrology we have all these people going back and looking up Project Hindsight or whatever and Ararat and all these, you know, digging up the ancient source material. And there's a sort of a fundamentalist mindset that we need to go back to the one pure way when from what you're saying here, the one pure way is pretty tainted from where we are in our consciousness evolution now.
Yeah, and what I will say is that there is relevance and wisdom with traditional things and Capricorn. That archetype is as valid as any other. However, the shadow of that archetype is to limit the transpersonal. Is the mythic castration of Saturn castrating Uranus, is that is the shadow that we need to be careful about with Saturn and Capricorn, because it is legitimate for its own scope, but it has the tendency to deny progress and future things and an evolution. And that's why Aquarius follows Capricorn. It corrects the imbalance of the prior sign. And that's why Uranus is a broader truth than Saturn. And Saturn orbits within Uranus. And so ideally we need these things to be in partnership with one another, but the challenge is oftentimes Capricorn or Saturn wants to castrate progress and dismiss it and not even entertain it, because it disrupts the order and the and the history of things. And so that's really what the crux of the issue is. But Capricorn Saturn isn't the problem. It's the misuse of that energy, which is.
Which at a global level right now, we're seeing a lot of that problem crop up with Pluto empowering the Capricorn structures, being square to, you know, a conflict for growth to Uranus over in Aries, the sign of the radical individual, you know, rising up against it.
It's such a graphic portrayal of what we're speaking about. I mean, even in this presidential election, you really see the plutocracy that Mitt Romney is kind of representing about empowering those who have power and concentrating it into a small elite group of people, and everyone else is going to be underlings. And that kind of mindset is really the dark Pluto in Capricorn, and that's the extension of the dark Capricorn that doesn't incorporate Uranus Aquarius, if it turns into that. And then it darkens and it contracts, and it's not healthy. And that's my fear of, my concern of conventional or traditional paradigms that don't bring in Uranian things, is that Saturn's a contracting energy. And in final contraction to its logical end, and you get extinction. And I think that this time frame with Pluto and Capricorn, if we don't change the way we exist on this planet, if we don't honor the Earth and the natural resources and other people, and we're not living interdependently rather than in this elitist way, then I do think that things are going to get hairy and very challenging, if not crisis, if not even potentially extinction.
Yeah, and you know, in my cycle, looking back at the cycles of Jupiter Saturn through the elemental waves, I found that most countries, you know, are on these Pluto cycles of 250 years. Sometimes they last three cycles, like the Ottoman Empire. Sometimes they only last one cycle. But here we are, coming up on our Pluto return in the next, you know, 10 years or so. When it gets, I think it's 2024 or something like that. And where are we going to go from here? You know, in terms of this. It seems like when we started this country, it was like we were overthrowing a plutocracy in terms of like the English Empire, you know, and now we're back to square one, trying to deal with it again.
It makes me think of the Who song, Won't Get Fooled Again, where he talks about bye to the old boss, hello to the new boss, same as the old boss. It's like, okay, what we just banished is what we've become.
Yeah. So the thing is that, you know, despite the world and its obvious contractions and declines and suffering, it has no real bearing on your spiritual journey unless you want it to. Because awakening is awakening. And I'm glad you read Jed McKenna's book on spiritual awakening, The Damnedest Thing. I'm glad you brought him into your book because I like the distinction he makes between enlightenment, which is truth realization that we're all part of this unity consciousness that pervades everything, and the whole mystical experience of, like, you know, emotional bliss in oneness, you know?
Yeah, like I like how he says, no, let's be honest. You know, if you want to have blissful experiences, why don't you go do a lot of drugs? If you really want enlightenment, you know, then you got to grow up. It's not about that. It's about, you know, being in, you know, awareness of all that is. It's not preferring anything that is, you know, transcendent or positive or recreational or what have you. That's it's not about positive states of consciousness, although that certainly could be part of it. It's not about that. It's just abiding in spiritual realization.
Totally.
Which is very different. You know, so I talk about that in the book, is that one of the big mistakes that I see in astrology is equating Neptune with what one might call enlightenment. Neptune isn't about enlightenment, in my view. The sun is about light and enlightenment, in my view, about the awareness and presence of being spirit and being source energy. Neptune is a whole different, you know, set of issues.
Like Neptune disillusionment?
disillusion of attachments and visioning processes and compassion. And to me, Neptune is very Buddhist, or very Eastern in scope. But it's not necessarily about being in awareness, which in my view, that's what the sun is about.
Yeah, and it might be,
you know, the sun gives light to Neptune, is that you can't have these states of consciousness, this this compassion, this contemplative experiences, if the sun, the source energy, awareness itself, isn't casting its light on that. So everything revolves around the sun, is my view, and the sun is around presence, which is heat, and awareness, which is light. And to me, that is the soul realization.
Yeah, when I was reading your book, I was thinking about space travel in the future, and I was thinking that if we could somehow turn ourselves into energy, like the sun, it might be that the key to getting to other star systems isn't going away from our star out into the cold darkness of space, but actually going into it and through it into the astral light dimension where everything's connected, you know? And I was like, that would be cool.
Well, that's a great little point that you made. You just mentioned energy. And that's, you know, people have some difficulty. What does it mean, the transpersonal? And real simply, it's identifying as energy. Is that the physicality, to me, the moon is our physicality, and the moon itself, of course, is a physical rock out there orbiting this planet. And the sun is metaphysical. It's energy. And identifying as energy rather than identifying in the physical form is part of the transpersonal. And so it's not as sexy, so to speak, to identify as energy because there isn't an ego involved. There isn't needs. It's just being with what is. It's just the creative source energy that flows through us and everything is that we identify. It's beyond the personal is what transpersonal is. And so part of what the awakening process, in my view, is realizing that we're not just physical. We are metaphysical. We have energy that exists and radiates beyond our physicality and connects to all of life. And so to identify as having a light body or an energy body that I am all of that. I'm not limited to the confines of my separation, of my physicality. And then, of course, we still are. We have bodies, we have names, we have stories, we have identities. It's the sacred marriage. I read a whole chapter in the book that it isn't about the spiritual bypass and getting away from the physical, but about integrating the sacred marriage of bringing that broader spiritual creativity into form through your physicality, through your unique gifts that you have. But we don't want to be too overly identified and attached to the physicality. Well, that's where we've been. We're learning to expand and say, oh, my God, I'm nothing. I'm nobody. I'm just energy. And at the same time, I'm also physical. So we have to bridge worlds is the phrase that I use in the book.
Totally. One of the centerpieces in my philosophy is that the body itself is very sacred and holy. And that this other thing that you're talking about, you know, the energy body, the, you know, the sun exists in terms of solid, liquids, and gases. It's a combination of all three. It's a plasma, you know. So we have like this plasmatic body. That's this spiritual energy field that permeates everything. And it doesn't have to be an either or. It can be a both and, you know, because we are in it and it is in us. And yet we are in these little forms trying to do our life missions. I always say at the beginning of readings, I always say, you were born in response to a spiritual need on this planet and to fulfill your dharma, to wake up to your full potential of your talents and your, that are depicted in your astrological chart is to step into that need and to fulfill that need, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. And, the bridging of the world. Yeah, absolutely. And so, we all uniquely have, a lot of work here on the physical level of separation consciousness, and we need to attend to that. And the more we do that from an awakened or evolved consciousness, the more not only can we resolve and heal our own karmic tendencies, but then we contribute. We always teach what we're learning. And then we give the world a gift that's an extension of our curriculum. And that's how we can really help the whole, you know, world evolve when we do our own work. So it's all intertwined. Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah, one of the reasons I came back to Boulder and canceled my wandering the world journey is because I saw that in Jupiter-Saturn conjunction in Aquarius in 2020 was beginning a 200-year period of Jupiter-Saturn conjunctions in the air signs, which have corresponded historically to Renaissance periods. Even back in Sumeria, it was called the Sumerian Renaissance by historians in 2700 BCE. So these renaissances have been building. And these waves, like the Industrial Revolution we're just coming out of with the Earth wave, they've been combining everything from every period in history, every 800 years. So this one's a global renaissance. So one of the reasons I came back to Boulder is to build an academy of metaphysics and astrology where we can, like, you know, get polymaths. You know, people have mastered multiple gifts and get them out on the front lines of humanity, you know? So that's kind of my mission by looking at my chart, being all Sag, Rising, Gemini, Moon, like to teach in Aquarius, you know, tap into the astrology, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I got that 12th house north node conjunct Mars and in Aquarius in the 12th is, you know, there is a lot of a sense of, okay, well, where is humanity going? What is the vision that we're all collectively evolving into? So I, too, am fascinated. You know, you and I both have that big 12th house emphasis there.
Yeah, and the Mars and the North Node in Aquarius. So we're like, we're here to get over ourselves, Leo South Node, and do something for humanity.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'll teach you what we're learning. I mean, my own chart, I've got the Leo Moon in the South Node, and there is a self preoccupation. You know, I didn't fully get the transpersonal. I was more surrounded by, you know, approval and personality things in my soul. And so I'm teaching what I'm learning. I'm getting out of my ego too. Of course, we're all teaching what we're learning. And so, you know, there's, you know, everyone has that situation in some way.
Totally, totally. One of the things that you have been focusing on in terms of the moon, you know, I've read a lot of your books and thought about your concept of the moon and everything being the real ego here, you know, and in talks with other astrologers about this, I've come across, you know, some who say, oh, Eric's trying to castrate the moon from the chart, you know, and then others have said, no, here's what he's doing. And just putting the sun at its central focus point of light and spiritual energy in the flow. And I like how you make the point in the book. I mean, it's almost like several points in the book, you stop to kind of clarify that. And you say, no, I'm not saying the moon's a bad thing. I'm just pointing out how it can be problematic and how...
Well, here's the way to describe it, is that we all have a false self that we erect to comply with everyday life. You know, it's not who you are. It's the way you respond to your conditioning. How are you? I'm fine. You know, really? Is that really who you are? Is that really what's going on? Or is that a conditioned response? And part of the incarnation is that we have to develop a false self in many ways. Just the way the culture and society and school, that's just the way it is. In order, we just become a product of our experiences around us. And all of this turns into an identification and attachments. And that's what the moon portrays. And so my view is that we need to clear out the false self and what it's holding on to and have the moon be a vessel, a receptacle, a physical vessel that contains spiritual creativity and awareness. So the moon is absolutely central to bridge worlds. But we need to release the false self that we inhabit. You know, here's one example that's really easy that, you know, that I give in some of the talks I give. If you have an experience that's unresolved that turns into your moon, let's say hypothetically you get bit by a dog, then you're going to be fearful of dogs and you might have a story that dogs are bad and they hurt you, and you're going to be organizing your whole life around not getting bit by a dog, and you're hearing that story and that way of being, and is that real or is that the false self? Is that really the reality or not? And so my view is that we're all holding on to things in the moon that are unresolved, that are based on not being completely at peace and love with prior experiences, and so it's defense mechanisms, and it contracts us. And the moon is teeny. 64 million moons fit inside the sun, and this is analogous to what we're holding on to in our stories and our attachments. It's insignificant to the broader, huge awareness of the sun, and so we have to release these preoccupations, these defense mechanisms, these attachments and identifications, because it contracts reality into a certain story. And so a lot of the moon needs to be resolved and released. And think about this. On the astrology wheel, the moon goes with the fourth house. That's what roots us to the world. And the final house is the 12th house, which is about releasing attachments. So we have to have attachments in order to be here, and then paradoxically, in order for us to grow, we need to release those attachments in order to have renewal, which is the ascendant. And so so much of our curriculum here is investing in life, getting, you know, immersed in these experiences and then learning to let them go. But yeah. most people don't let it go, and therefore the moon has a lot of remnants from the past, and that's what needs to mature. So my view is not that the moon needs to be bypassed or in any way, you know, removed. It needs to be matured. Mm-hmm. It needs to mature by more awakened consciousness where we realize that we've been at the helm. We have been co-creating our lives. We are the architect and the director of our ego dream. So when we take responsibility for the way we've navigated in our ego dream, then we can have a more mature relationship with the moon rather than, you know, having all these judgments like dogs are bad and you know, mailmen are good or whatever the hell it is.
Yeah.
And that's what the moon does. It strategizes in a lot of good, bad, dualistic, you know, evaluations. And when you're caught in that, you can't awaken to oneness.
Well, what I was going to say was also, you know, I like how in this book you actually go through each of the planets and say, okay, here's how you can use Mercury in a very egoic way, or here's how you can use Mercury in a very awakened way so it can play a more evolved role. So in a sense, you've taken that same concept and expanded it to each planet. Like, here's how Venus works on the egoic level, you know, of self-worth and all, but then also there's this awakened spiritual way of using Venus that's really cool, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I go through all the planets around the awakened versus egoic, but just to finish up on the moon, what the core of what the moon really needs is love. And when we don't feel love in our experiences, something's amiss, because the natural condition of the moon, and this is what Cancer is about, and I'm a Cancer sun. And so there's no way, you know, I'm not about, you know, moving away from the moon. All about for radiating the high, loving qualities of the moon. And so most of us have not been receiving love and experiencing that in all of our experiences. So we hold on to it because that's what we really need. If we're going to be honest about it, we really need and require love. That's what being human is about. And so so self-love is really turned into the focus of my work. Is that the moon needs to be loved. We need to love ourselves. We need to be in our loving heart center, not to escape it, not to pretend that we don't have these needs, or not to project them on the world and say it's other people's responsibility. So my view is that the awakening process gathers momentum from the position of unconditional self-love and acceptance. Because if you don't have unconditional self-love and acceptance, then you're prone to the spiritual bypass. You just want all these experiences, it's like escape. Oh, I'm going to connect with spirit guides and energy out there and just, woo, everything is going to be wonderful. Well, are you really coming from your center, or is that an escape, a subtle unconscious escape mechanism? But because when we're in our loving heart center, then all of those transpersonal experiences become much more meaningful and integrated because we're connected to ourselves. And so my view is that the moon just needs to mature into greater self-love rather than the unresolved quality of most people's moons that didn't have the love that they really required, and then that plays out into the false self. And so that's really my view. So, you know, it's disappointing sometimes to hear that the misinterpretation of my work around the moon, because actually I'm a Cancer, and my work is about loving the moon, not about abandoning it.
Yeah. I guess the joke could be made that since your moon is in mutual reception with your sun over in Leo, that it's championing the sun at its own cause, you know, because the moon's in Leo, you know. So it's like, hey, the sun's better than the moon, you know. But I get where you're going with it, and it's cool. But I you know, and you're doing it with all the planets, really. One thing I like.
And so that whole idea of better is when someone uses that language, then I know for sure that they're not getting the point.
Yeah.
Because there's no good, bad judgments with any of it. So you haven't heard me use those words. Is that that's the whole point is to get away from looking at things as good or bad.
Exactly.
You know, my view is that we're talking about more conscious versus less conscious. And being less conscious is not bad or worse.
Yeah.
Just like being 2 years old is not worse than being 28 years old. It's just less developed.
There's
no value judgment whatsoever. So the moon is a window into our less developed, less resolved, less conscious version, and in no way would I ever say that any of that is bad, just like I wouldn't say that it's bad to be a five-year-old.
Totally. Like, my moon's a Gemini, and I love to write. Writing is my favorite experience on the earth, so I nurture that. I give myself time every day to go and open myself to the zen of the blank page, you know, and my moon in Gemini is happy, but it's in the seventh house, so I have to go do it out in public somewhere, you know, at a coffee shop where there's people I can see going by. I don't necessarily want to interact. Sometimes I do, and do someone's chart on the fly or whatever, but most of the time it's just about the sacred writing, you know, and that moon in Gemini just feels so emotionally content when I can give that space to that, you know?
Yeah, like my view is that we're learning to do the moon more consciously. And so you have a Gemini moon, is that the more regressive part of that might be scattered, might be interested in a million different things and not being, applying oneself, you know, with focus and diligence is some of the shadow of Gemini moon. But then the high Gemini moon is the love of writing and the love of ideas is maturely being developed rather than, coming from, you know, less mature consciousness. So everyone's moon is a window into a part of your regression, part of your less mature way of being, just like we have an inner child. You know, we have tendencies from 8 years old or 12 years old or whatever that are still within us. That's the moon. And then it matures, and then you get to do the high Gemini with your moon, and that will be really satisfying. And when I do the high Leo with my moon, I feel very satisfied. And when I do the low Leo, which is, you know, indulgence that doesn't have any purpose, I don't really feel good about myself. Mm-hmm. And people who do the shadow of the moon, it's not very satisfying.
Totally. I like how you make this point that the moon depends on the sun to hold it and the earth and the whole solar system, because the sun's been here a long time before all these planets and all. And
well, the sun gives light to the moon.
Yeah.
And there is no moonlight. It's only reflected sunlight, which is indicative of the human condition. It's a reflection of spirit. And that's my view. So if you view the sun and moon as the masculine and feminine, I'm still asking anyone, please, I'm dying for an explanation from conventional astrologers. Somebody please tell me how the feminine is a reflection of the masculine. Somebody, you know, alert me to that. Or how is the moon, 64 million moons fit inside the sun, and the sun is at the center and the moon orbits around. How is that a reflection of the two genders? I really want to know. If we're going to hold on to that paradigm, I need some adequate answers, because it makes a lot more sense if we look at the sun as source energy and the moon as a human condition that's a reflection of source energy, and we're a lot smaller than the sun. But of course, way back hundreds of years ago from the position of Earth, the apparent reality was that the sun and moon are the same size and they both have their light source. And so it's easy to go into that dualistic, you know, pairing of masculine and feminine, but that's living before Copernicus, yeah, and before science and before what we now know about the astronomy. And so my view, of course, we should update the paradigm, because if not, we're living pre-1500s.
Yeah. And in some cultures, you know, the ancient Babylonians who created astrology saw the moon as male. They called it Namu, and they saw it as very masculine. And in other cultures like Japan, they saw the sun as being very feminine, Amaterasu, you know, the goddess of...
My view is that the moon orbits within Saturn, and Saturn sets up separation consciousness and dualism.
Yeah.
And so the moon is our humanness, in my view, the requirements to eat and sleep and to take care of your body and needs for love. And do men have emotions? Do men have unconsciousness? Do men have families? And see the dualism within Saturn. Everything within Saturn gets split in dualistic ways. Mars is fight or flight. And the moon, to me, can, of course, be masculine and feminine, because the human condition has both, and they're both interdependent within that. And so if men do have emotion and families and unconsciousness, they have a moon. It's not just projected on the feminine. That, to me, is patriarchy. Women are the ones who are in charge of nurturing and nourishing and things that are messy about the human condition. They should be nurses and teachers. You know, that's the projection. Yeah. To women should to be the moon. And men, we are spirit. We're the source energy. Everything revolves around us. That's,
yeah,
the patriarchal fantasy.
Totally.
Is that the sun is masculine, in my view. And so I realize that this is not a very popular view for many people, but I think it's much more accurate with the astronomy and with reality.
Yeah. Well, one of the things in my chart I've realized is over the years is that my moon reflects more about my relationship with my dad, and my sun, my sun reflects more my relationship with my mom. So I kind of let go of the whole attachment to be the sun being masculine, the moon being feminine. And just saying, hey, there's masculine and feminine universe, and it can come out any which way. Because, you know, my moon in Gemini is on my dad's Gemini ascendant. We play Scrabble together. We love language together, you know. We watch football games together. My mom has an Aquarius sun. I'm an Aquarius sun. My mom has Aquarius rising with Aquarius moon. And it's like, it was rebellious as hell and divorced my dad and rode off on a motorcycle, you know. And so she's just like total liberated rebel figure, you know, and I'm like, dude, I get my son from my mom.
With this is that the whole archetype of moon, cancer, and fourth house is your roots, is your family, is your lineage, is what you inherit, and everything involved with our roots and family circles back to the moon, and then the sun is the individuation process, the development, the awakening, and certainly your mom can be supporting your process of awakening with these solar contacts. And this is one of the first things that I noticed when I got into astrology. You know, I've got a Leo moon, and my dad is very charismatic and visible, and a lot of people know him. He's a doctor in the area, and he's well-known, and he's on the board of education, and he runs for office. He's a very charismatic guy. And my mom is very introverted and quiet and not very visible. And so for me, my Leo moon was like, wait a second. You know, that seems to be more about my dad, but broader. I said, wait a second, that's my lineage with the family, mm-hmm. with the Myers, with the whole archetype here goes with more of that. And so my view is that things on a dualistic level are within the moon. The moon orbits within Saturn, and the moon orbits the Earth. So we're surrounded by lunar energy, and we tend to project that and see things in dualistic ways, and that's the relative level. And then the sun is beyond. In fact, Saturn is dependent upon the sun. And the sun is transpersonal awareness. And transpersonal means beyond the personal. And so unity consciousness. And so to me, that is really what's happening here, is that most of us are actually wedded and you know, it just encircles us, lunar consciousness, of looking at everything dualistically. And my view is that that keeps you within Saturn. And then you never get to Uranus and the transpersonal. And so the sun itself, in my view, doesn't go with dualistic pairings. It's beyond that.
Yeah.
Saturn is dependent upon the sun. The sun is the energy that allows Saturn to even exist. And so only things within Saturn mm-hmm. are within the dualistic world. And you can see that with Jupiter is within. This is the right way to live. This is the wrong way to live. Mars, fight or flight. You know, Venus, this feels good, this doesn't feel good. Mercury, good or bad, or any dualistic pairing. And the moon, male and female, in my view.
Totally, yeah, the sun, I always say, is the source of spiritual illumination and the path of self-realization. So if you're living your sun sign, you're going to have vitality, you're going to feel like you have a sense of purpose, and you're on fire, literally, with your life.
Yeah, exactly. And we identify as energy with the sun. It isn't about me. I am borrowing energy, and I get to use this spiritual creativity, this energy temporarily. This is my life force. And so to me, the paradigm shift has to do with the understanding that we borrow energy rather than we claim ownership on it. And that's the theme of the Awakening book. And so when we identify as souls having human experiences, we are not attached to the ownership of the human experience. We are just using the human vehicle as a tool to bring spiritual creativity, the sun, into manifestation in the 3D world.
Totally, totally.
But it's not about us.
Yeah.
And egoic takeover is the term I use in the book to imply when we claim ownership. Like, look at me, how I'm so special. And it's all about, you know, no one else could do what I've done. You know, that's the ego takeover. No, you're just channeling spiritual energy in a certain way, and you don't even realize that it has nothing to do with you. You're just, you know, creating the folly of owning it. We're only vessels for it. We're only instruments. And to me, that is the paradigm shift.
Totally. And the moon, what the sun can bring, if you're doing your sun, I always say you'll have more vitality. So you can get beyond fatigue, which ails modern society, you know? And then depression is another ailment of modern society. And I say when you're doing your moon right, and you're really living out that archetype and at this beautiful spiritual transpersonal level, you know, by its sign placement, house placement, and aspects, you basically won't get depressed because you'll be really happy and you won't be caught up in all the illusions of grasping and fear and false desire and all that stuff.
Yeah. And that's the real motion of the moon, is that we have to release the attachments to what we thought who we are and what would make us happy, because a lot of the moon is based on defense mechanisms and survival. That's what the ego is main job, or her main job, its main job is survival. And so how many people can be enlightened when you're in survival mode? You can't be. And so we have to release the attachments to that, because it plays a role. It's necessary to have this survival instinct, you know, to get hungry. I need to go get some food. I need to connect with like-minded people. I need to have nurturing bonds. I need to have all my ducks in a row in order to be okay. That's what the moon does. It sees to our survival. But if we're only in survival mode, you're not going to be able to, you know, incorporate greater spiritual realization because you're preoccupied with the basic levels of functioning.
Totally. So when it comes to awakening, though, you know, let's go into that more, because the thing is, like, when I was writing about awakening, when I had my first awakening experiences through sports, you know, getting in the zone and seeing into, like, that we're all connected and there's a oneness that transcends this feeling of separateness. And when I cultured that and worked with that over many years, I started just, like Jed says, you know, truth realization, man. If you're all one, what's the big problem here? How could you? I mean, I was a martial artist, and I was taught to all these combat techniques. And I told my sensei I didn't really want to fight in tournaments because I said if I have to throw a punch, I've already lost the spiritual battle within to see that my enemy is my friend, you know. And, So I went through these, but I went through stages of awakening, you know, where I learned astrology and started learning the symbolisms, and then I began serving others with that gift, and that was kind of like the next stage. It's almost like there were seasons within my awakening, and now I'm in this sort of fall of awakening where, you know, it becomes your whole life, you know, your research, your connection with that spiritual realm and being a channel for it into this realm. And I imagine the winter phase would be more about, like, you know, becoming like a Buddha, Christ, Jesus figure who just, like, is totally, it's just not flowing through you in, like, drops. It's just flowing through you like a mighty river, you know? So can you talk about awakening and what you, because the whole book is, you know, the astrology of awakening. So how do you define awakening?
I think it's basically, you know, moving from the identification of only in physicality to the metaphysical or the transpersonal or just energy, and realizing that you're existing in your own consciousness continually, that everything you experience is a reflection of you, that there is no objective reality, and everything is evaluated and seen in highly subjective, unique ways based on your experience. One example is a guy runs into a room wearing a ski mask. Someone had an traumatic experience with a robber or something, or a rapist when they were 10 years old who ran into the house, and they get re-traumatized. Another person was at a comedy club last night, and the comic was doing a skit with a ski mask on. And so one person's in horror, the other person's in hysterics in comedy with the same situation. So there is no objective reality. And part of awakening is the realization that everything that I experience is a reflection of me, echoing back to me. There's actually just one consciousness, the collective consciousness that we are all residing in. And we're all little teeny fragments of that that are reflecting that back to each other. And to me, part of the awakening is to recognize yourself in others. Just like namaste, I recognize the light of divinity in you, that I am you, you are me, we are one. And you're at one with everything. And so when we love the self internally, that's the moon, and we're coming from a centered, loving, separation consciousness foundation, we can really learn to recognize and love everything, no matter what it is, without any judgments of good or bad or whatever. We just accept life as it is. That is, learning lessons, and cycles are going around, and evolution's unfolding in perfect synchrony with a great elaborate dance, and we have no need to assert our agenda upon that, but we have the awareness that this is just necessary, and this is the way it is, and it's all in perfection and harmony, and we don't resist life anymore, but we are in collaboration. And then, so we're able to then use the vehicle of separation consciousness to play a role, to bridge these worlds, as I was saying, of exercising more of our awakened self to contribute to the collective evolution. But a lot of what it comes down to is moving beyond Saturn, which is separation consciousness and right or wrong or dualistic stuff, and being able to see things more in terms of the unity that exists. Because energetically, everything is interconnected. That's what we know for sure at the energetic level. That's what science tells us. That's what all wisdom traditions tell us, that there's oneness, there's one God, whatever you want to call it. Spirit is unified. And awakening is the ability to understand and experience that. And so there's different degrees of it, in my understanding. And the moon needs to be made conscious. We need to resolve what we're holding on to in separation. We need to resolve the karma, the nodes of the moon that help us reconcile some patterns that enable us to then further awaken into the promise of that. And then again, it isn't about escape or leaving. It's about bridging worlds. As long as you're alive, you're in physical form, it's about bridging these worlds. It's a crucial point. But the awakening process does have something to do with releasing our identification and our attachment to the separate self. And that's what a lot of spiritual teachers really are advocating and supporting with various, you know, contemplative practices and what have you, is how do you, you know, release those attachments. So how do you be in this world but not of it is a phrase that I like. How do you see your body itself as an instrument without being attached to it, saying, this isn't really mine, but I'm using it?
Totally.
It's a tool, just like a wrench is a tool. But most people have a strong identification with it, is that they can't move beyond it.
And I want to make the point. Yeah, I want to make the point, too, that when you say moving beyond Saturn, because that in and of itself is separation consciousness. You're saying, let's separate ourselves from Saturn. But in the book, you also talk about you have to get beyond ourselves to do Saturn well. And you even say, we must submit to the so-called Reaper, which holds the reality that we are going to die. Then we can awaken to our spiritual selves through the transpersonal planets. And the way I see it is that even Saturn and the Moon and the South Node, all these symbols are tools for awakening, really. And they can be done in a very spiritual way, or they can be done in a very egoic separation consciousness way.
Yeah. I want to build upon what you're saying, because part of Saturn is the complete radical acceptance of reality. And I put in a quote from Byron Katie in the Awakened Saturn section. I want to read it. Byron Katie writes, what happens is the best thing that can happen. People who can't see this are simply believing their own thoughts and have to stay stuck in the illusion of a limited world, lost in the war with what is. It's a war they'll always lose because it argues with reality, and reality is always benevolent. What actually happens is the best that can happen, whether you understand it or not, and until you understand it, there is no peace. And so our conventional view on Saturn is that it's malefic, not benevolent, and a lot of people see astrologers because they want to resist the reality and they want to strategize to when something good is going to happen, and therefore they stay locked within the soul cage of trying to get so-called positive experiences. But my view of evolution is the radical, complete, 1,000% acceptance of everything and all of reality is the way you get beyond Saturn. If you whatever resists, persists, and locks you into an argument with reality, and then you stay stuck within Saturn, and that's what most people chronically do almost all the time.
I know, we get so many clients that are afraid of their Saturn, and I always tell them, you will continue to suffer until you love your Saturn.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. is that not only do you have to accept Saturn, you have to love it, and you have to see, and this is where it gets difficult for people, because some people go into blaming the victim thing. That's not what I'm doing here. It's seeing that we, based on navigating unconsciously, created the difficulties, the challenging realities in our life. It wasn't these malevolent forces out there that are delivering punishment. It's you, all of us, navigating less consciously than we could. We were, you know, from an evolutionary view, I use the analogy of, like, school. You start out in nursery school, and eventually you might get a PhD, which, you know, can be analogous to being unconscious, to being enlightened. And so all of us need to start out in nursery school. We all navigated not so consciously, and we created things that were challenging that our ego didn't like, and we can blame the world and blame Saturn for that, or we can accept it as our own creation, our own co-creation, and then mature by accepting what we did and the lessons that we are co-creating, and therefore that heals it. And then you get to move beyond it, because that's what the lesson is to accept your co-creative relationship with the universe. But the paradigm that governs astrology is not about co-creation. It's here's what's going to happen, just like we opened up this conversation with, about prediction. There's no sense of co-creation there. Yeah. If the universe delivers reward and punishment, then we just have to make the best of it. And to me, that paradigm we have grown out of, and my prayer is that astrology can grow out of it, and I'm dedicating my life to that purpose.
Totally. I'm with you, man. I mean, in a sense, I actually never made it to that PhD level, even though that was my goal at first. But when I got to my junior year in college with a 4.0 in astrophysics and a minor in Japanese, I really just wanted to be an astrologer, and I realized they weren't going to allow that, so I had to move beyond the wheel of education itself, you know, and like my enlightenment was dropping out of the whole system altogether, and now my whole life work is to create a new system that will actually enable people to learn about their charts from this enlightened transpersonal perspective and find a path in life that is not some cookie cutter major that they got a degree with and show that they are good at following orders and putting answers on a test and then becoming a cog on the assembly line of consumerism. It's like, how can you be a spiritual being on this planet using all your gifts? Come on, people.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So much of what the awakening process is to say, oh, okay, I get it. I was not as conscious in prior lives or in this current life earlier on. And because I wasn't as conscious, here's the themes that I created, the energies that I drew to me. I mean, I'll just share one personal example. I've got the moon opposed to planet Mars. And when I wasn't very conscious, when I was a child, I used to get picked on all the time. I was antagonized and beat up. Mars opposed my moon. And part of my awakening is to see that I wasn't a victim of these bullies, that I wasn't in connection with my own Mars energy. I projected it out because I was afraid of Mars. I was not a leader. I was not strong and empowered. And so I said, you hold Mars energy. And then they did, and they reflected it back to me. So part of awakening is to see, oh, my God, I was interacting with myself through all those bullies and all those antagonism because I was co-creative, was projecting that ego dream out because my chart shows that I'm not coming in connection with my Mars. And so the more that I own my Mars, which is what I've been doing, you know, for many years, that's on my North Node. The more that I own my Mars, I don't project it out on other people anymore. I say, no, that's me. And I'm Marshall. And therefore that projection ceases and I own Mars and I become more whole. So we have to integrate with everything that's going on with our moon to reach greater wholeness. And then we're much more in charge of how we're projecting out our ego dream. And so awakening is really being more conscious of your moon, in my view.
Totally.
And until we're conscious of our moon, it plays out and returns to us in a million guises, and we don't recognize it because we're in separation conscious and we blame other people. But I no longer blame, you know, the people who have antagonized me throughout my life. I accept that as my own projection. And it doesn't happen very much anymore because I now love myself and I don't need to, you know, fight with myself through other people.
Totally. I had similar experience. I mean, I took the other road when I was a kid and all the older kids threw all the younger kids in these like rings and they made us fight each other. And they even placed bets on us. And I didn't know what was happening. I was like a little kid, you know? And this kid came and punched me in the face, and I was like, because I have moon opposite Mars, you know, by sign. And I was just like, I'm getting punched in the face. I'm going to start punching back. So I had to become really martial, you know, and strong and learn martial arts and never be defeated. And it continued into sports too, you know, where I had to become like super warrior, you know. But because I have an Aquarian, and I adopted a attitude of, you know, the sort of Robin Hood sort of rebel defender of the underdog. So I had all these nerdy friends in calculus and physics who came running to me saying, Kelly, protect us from your fellow football jocks. But it turned out that in the end of my journey, it became that I never needed to fight anybody, because I could transcend the conflict through conversation and through spiritual energy. And it was and Mars is in my 12th house, conjunct Jupiter and Neptune. So there's a strong ethical vibe with Jupiter saying, like, hey, don't pick on people. You know, so I went the other path of becoming defender of the underdog.
Yeah, well, a lot of what we're talking about is recognizing self in other, which is the awakening process of seeing that you're interacting with your own projections. It's no different than the movie Inception, which I highly recommend those who haven't seen it to see it, because it shows that everything in the dreamscape is your own projections that you're interacting with. It's all you. It's all different versions and guises of you. And so the awakening process is to see that and to act in accordance with that. And therefore, with Neptune in Pisces right now by transit, is about dreaming. It's about these processes of co-creating, the visionary process. And I believe that's a signal of Neptune moving into Pisces.
Crossing your ascendant, by the way.
I'm sorry?
I said crossing your ascendant, by the way.
Oh, yeah, that too. But part of Neptune in Pisces is the collective realization that life as we experience it is another layer of the dream. Mm-hmm. That there is no objective reality on planet Earth. It's all subjective, just like the ski mask example. We're all dreaming everything. We're all energetically are connected through our consciousness to all that we experience, and we draw it in, and we co-create it with what we draw in, and it's no different than a dream. It just appears because it involves the physical level. We get convinced that things are real, but it's all just temporary crystallization of consciousness is what the physical world is. This is a dreamscape is actually what the reality is. But in the Saturn world, says that's crazy. You know, we live with business and commerce, and you got to go to school, and you got to operate on the Earth plane, and that's silly talk. Is, you know, all of that is speculation. Let's be here now. Let's live in the real world. Get your head out of the clouds and be down to Earth. And that mentality has largely shaped Western civilization. And Saturn was the outermost planet when astrology was developed, and that is the governing ideation. What's going to happen? Does it have utility? Am I going to be able to win the war and be the king? What's the utility? What's the usefulness of things? Just the mundane. And we're waking up to the reality that there's life beyond Saturn, that in fact all of the Saturnian realm is within all of the transpersonal levels. And so it's a reflection of all those spiritual processes of the matrix, which is Uranus, of the interconnectedness of intelligent energy, and Neptune is the dream space in my view, and Pluto is this evolutionary intelligence that's operating. All of that Saturn is orbiting within. And so when we castrate the transpersonal, we just are left with the here and now of the bottom line of profit margins and what's good or bad, and then we'd never awaken. And my concern is that the way astrology, the paradigm that governs astrology, keeps us within the Saturnian realm, and so it actually can prevent awakening.
Yeah, there was a physicist here at the game. I had a game night, strategy game night, and I started talking about astrology, and he immediately harped in about, like, well, you can't predict, blah, 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 blah. And I said, well, your statement shows that you have no idea what astrology is really about. So why don't you go study it first and then come back and we'll talk. But anyway, yeah, that's what I say. Is like, what the thrust you're making here is that, in a sense, if we go out and cultivate the transpersonal level of consciousness that is exemplified by the Uranus, Neptune, Pluto, you know, divine mind, divine love, divine will, whatever, then we can come back to the personal planets with a more awakened ability to utilize them as tools for the purpose of whatever our incarnation's about. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and I think that one of the real clear signals of are we able to operate in the transpersonal way or not is the tendency to view things with good or bad, positive, negative language. Is that because that's all dualistic and that's all strategizing of what is favorable or not. Where spirit is just is. It's beyond value judgments, the transpersonal level. You know, I don't believe that spirit is rooting for one football team to win over another,
yeah,
contrary to what Tim Tebow might think or others.
Yeah.
Is that we get beyond good and bad judgments and we see things in a more unified way. So that's the barometer. So astrology that uses a lot of good and bad language, in my view, is operating only within separation consciousness and therefore is prone to inhibiting beyond that, which is Uranus. And I talk about in the Awakening book that at the Uranian level, there is no value judgments. Everything has evolutionary value. Spirits are not messed up by making viruses or sicknesses or whatever, things that the ego considers bad. There's actually evolutionary purpose to everything.
Yeah.
Nothing is a mistake and accidental. Everything has evolutionary purpose. So spirit astrologers or other paths that are heavy with good-bad distinctions, in my view, inhibit awakening.
Totally.
And so the conventional paradigm is loaded with good, bad judgments about everything in the astrological system is seen as good or bad,
yeah,
malefic or benefic or helpful or unhelpful. That's all for the ego,
totally,
not for soul development. And that, to me, is the distinction that we need to have.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in total alignment with you there because, I mean, ever since I started teaching astrology when I was 21, I studied it since I was 14, and my teacher really emphasized this kind of perspective, unified perspective as well. And so when I started teaching, one of the first things I said was like, hey, there are no goods and bads in astrology anymore. There's just energy. And how do you want to use this energy with your consciousness and co-create your life amidst a lot of other people who are co-creating their lives, some in awakened ways, some in very unconscious ways?
Yeah, so what happens is that I have clients all the time who I'm talking to them about stuff and they say, oh, is that good or bad? And I say, well, that's up to you. Is that it's always a large spectrum between dark and unconscious and bright and awakened. And I don't know where someone's going to register on that broad spectrum. And so things that the ego might consider good is if you can respond to it from more bright, aware responses. If they respond to it in dark, unconscious ways, then it probably will manifest negatively. But it's up to you. So when someone says to me, is this good or bad? I say, it's up to you. Here's the range. Here's what this transit, let's say Saturn coming to, I don't know, Jupiter, this is the darker version of this, and that's available, and here's the bright version of this, and that's available too. It's really up to you of how you want to co-create what this is going to be about for you. But in and of itself is not good or bad. That's your job.
Yeah.
Is because think about it, at the transpersonal level, it's just energy. And then at the dualistic separation level, we have duality, which is good and bad, and that's where you are, and that's how you co-create through your response if something's going to be good or bad. But to say that Saturn is bad and Jupiter is good is ridiculous in my view, because
yeah,
there's a dark Jupiter and a bright Saturn, then what do you do with that?
Exactly. So that's why I like this approach, because this, in a way, also has the added benefit of taking the astrologer off the guru chair, because that way people don't have to see us to try to make their decisions for them when they can make their decisions for themselves. And like Jed McKenna does in his book, Spiritual Awakening, he's like, I ain't no guru. I'm just playing Tomb Raider and talking about what's truth. You know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like,
yeah. And I do think that astrologers and a lot of people are not going to like me saying this, but you know, I think we need to have more criticism within the field. And I'm a Uranus Mercury person, and I'm willing to say things, so they're not very popular, is that I do think that astrologers are at risk of having that oracular kind of seer narcissism.
Yeah.
And it gives them a sense of power, and they have a hierarchical relationship with the client. And I think there's a lot of ego traps in there.
Yeah.
So the way that I choose to work is with a lot more humility, and I call it a consultation rather than a reading.
Yeah.
Because a reading to me is like, okay, I'm the one in the favored, glorified position, and let me, you know, tell you how it's going to be in your life.
Yeah.
And my view is I don't have the answers for you. I have the questions for you,
yeah.
and you get to answer them based on playing your hand consciously, and here's how I can support you in doing that.
Totally.
So it isn't so much that the astrologer in this glorified position, it's the astrologer in a humble, helpful position of pointing out what the themes and dynamics and lessons are so the client can navigate more consciously. It has nothing to do with the astrologer.
Totally.
And so I do think that astrology itself needs to shift to this more humble kind of orientation with the way that we do our profession.
Totally. I have a similar thing. I mean, I do practice a form of divine inspiration. That's why I call my website Divine Inspiration Astrology. But it's not because I'm like some ego-inflated guy who wants to be seen as some guru. That's like the last thing I want. I'd rather just stay on an island by myself. But when I see clients, I specifically guide them away from calling it a reading as well. Because to me, it's like the ancients called it consideration to be with the stars, sidereal being the stars. They used to call them considerations. We're sitting down to have a consideration. And my job is not to give you some answers like the old kind of oracles. I say that astrology is oracular in the sense that you are connecting with the transpersonal realm. But the goal is to leave here with greater questions than you had coming in, you know? Not to get a bunch of answers.
No, it's up for the person to answer the questions of their life. It's not the astrologer's job to give them the answers. And so that's another part of the shift. And I do think, you know, here again, at risk of saying things that might be unpopular, but I'm getting more and more used to it, is that Pluto and Virgo generation, is that that's our job as Pluto and Virgos, is to bring that humility, bring that sense of service.
Yeah.
And then there's also a dark side to Pluto and Virgo. And every generation is helping resolve the dark side of the previous one. And so the dark side of the Pluto and Leo generation is some of this narcissistic, and it's not just about astrology. We find that in politics and entertainment and across the board.
Yeah.
Is that there's a real jubilation. There's a real transformation into greater joy and participation and more grandeur energy of Leo. I love Leo. Nothing wrong with Leo, but Pluto can be a darker, kind of shadowy type of thing. And not everybody in the Pluto and Leo generation is enlightened, I don't think. So they're going to play out some of that shadow. And so Pluto and Virgo is cleaning that up.
Yeah, we
and
are.
And the Pluto and Libras will clean up some of the Virgo shadow that you and I and others are leaving behind. That's just how each generation builds on its predecessor. But in order for that to happen, there needs to be passing the torch from one generation to the next. And when there's a resistance to that, then it gets even darker. And then the Pluto and Leo tendencies become very dark and obvious if there isn't the passing of the torch.
Totally.
And that just needs to happen.
Yeah, when I was being an astrologer at the age of 21 in Key West and going to all these like gatherings and parties and things, and people like really glamorized our profession, and it kind of made me want to throw up, you know? And I was just like, dude, because I have Pluto in Virgo, but it's on the border because it's like 29, 40-something Virgo. So it's right there in Libra, too. And I have a 3-degree Libra midheaven, so I make it into an art form, you know, a cosmic therapy through art and teaching and inspiration. But I think the Pluto in Virgo, we became masters of techniques. We create all these software programs, and we can, like, do all the old stuff that it used to take years to learn how to do in 5 minutes. And now we're like, okay, let's get back to, really, really being humbly, of service, like the old magi who were also magistrates. You know, they were governors. They had to, the word magic or magistrate or magi, they all go together, you know?
To say that part of the shadow of Pluto and Virgo is being professional patients, of being sick, of being, you know, drawn into, I'm not good enough. I always need to, have the right supplements and the right exercise regimen and this, yeah. And if I don't do all this, then there's a lot of anxiety with Pluto and Virgo. You know, that's the shadow there, is being professionally patient or never evolved enough and one more thing, and it's exhausting and exasperating, and therefore Pluto and Libra helps evolve in the direction of greater balance and harmony and calm. And then that has its own shadow as well, and on it goes.
Yeah.
But I think that this generational quality is where we're at, because I remember Gary Caton wrote in The Mountain Astrologer, you know, we've elected a Pluto in Virgo president. Are we ready to now, you know, welcome in the Pluto and Virgo astrologers more so now that the president is part of this generation, or not? Are we still going to, you know, keep the doors closed to that? And I think that's really where the Uranus Pluto square in terms of the field of astrology is around opening it up more,
yeah,
from the way that it's been concretized and the way it's become kind of bureaucratized or in politics of certain things. I think a lot of that is becoming very evident in the field. And I think the UAC process in 08, a lot of people were upset with a lot of the politics of that and some of the issues. So I think that is one illustration of the Uranus Pluto square in itself, is opening up things that can become, you know, plutocratic.
So, hey, talk a little bit about your using the stages of consciousness from that Wilbur approach and how you're using it to develop a conscious approach to astrology.
Well, I think that the main point of that section is understanding that there are levels of consciousness, that Wilbur points out 9 levels of consciousness that he has found in all of his extensive cross-cultural and historical research of different models throughout history and different cultures, is that he's identified 9 distinct stages of consciousness. Now, this is the crucial point, is that if consciousness evolves through these 9 stages, which there's very excellent evidence that it does, then everything cannot be looked at in one way. Because then you're just collapsing it to one stage. And that is what I'm pointing out in the book, is that early on, at a pretty egoic level of consciousness, astrology developed and became concretized at that one stage, and not just perpetuate that one stage of consciousness. And therefore, in order for astrology to evolve, you know, it needs to go through these different stages. And therefore, the organization and how we use the field necessarily adapts and reforms, because it's reflective of another stage of consciousness. And so therefore, the unwillingness to reform astrology then keeps us pretty much organized and locked into a level of consciousness that, in my view, is very egoically organized and focused. And what's happening is, and I talk about this in the book, is that a lot of people interested in spiritual growth are not as attracted to astrology. There's become a great gap between those interested in awakening and interested in transpersonal studies, interested in higher realms of consciousness. They tend not to be as attracted to astrology the way that it's currently done, or they find their own version of it, like I've done, and many others, where they have their own take on things, mm-hmm, and their own, you know, uniqueness with it. But we're seeing now this split between those interested in higher consciousness, or call it what you will, awakening, with astrology. Armin Diaz writes in the Integral Astrology book, he says, it's very rare to see an astrologer invited to conferences about the development of consciousness studies, transpersonal psychology, is that there's a huge fracture. And so this is very personal to me, because I have my master's in transpersonal psychology. I went to Naropa. I'm very much interested in those things.
Me too.
And I'm also have a foot in the camp of astrology, and they're not very integrated.
Yeah.
And so
we're both in the same camp there.
Yeah, these things need to be integrated and healed, and the only way we're going to do that is to organize astrology at a more developed level of consciousness. because there's many more levels, as I point out in the book, than how it's currently organized.
Yeah, when I was in college, I ended up changing my major before I dropped out completely. I changed my major to dynamics of consciousness. I had an individually structured major where I was studying Jungian archetypes and astronomy and physics, and then also Japanese and Eastern studies. So I just kind of designed my own program. My professors actually said, like, Kelly, you should just go to Naropa. And I was just like, and then what happened was I realized that they didn't want astrology in there, and the system was rigged against astrology. And so I was just like, I was like you, I had a foot in each camp, but with a deep allegiance to both, you know, the evolution of consciousness and consciousness studies, and then the astrological fact that we're living in a star system, on a planet orbiting a star, in a galaxy, in the whole cosmic consciousness component.
Yeah. And one thing I point out in the book, you know, is that every single field, you name it, from the auto industry to advances in casinos, to music, or you name it, ecology, anything has evolved.
Mm-hmm.
Across the board, every single field has modernized to some degree, has evolved. Everyone's now on a computer instead of a typewriter. Mm-hmm. Our cars are different than the Model Ts 100 years ago. Everything transforms. I mean, even in our short lifetime, I mean, remember when we were kids, we had dial phones, and there was no such thing as a cell phone or an email account. We all make adaptations. This is just what evolution is about, and it's across the board.
We played Atari.
One of the greatest surprises to me is the reluctance within the field of astrology to go along with every other field with sensible modernizations and adaptations. And to me, and as offensive as this may sound, it's no different than fundamentalist religions who want to preserve, you know, a literal interpretation of the Bible or something from yesteryear, that it cannot be adapted, it cannot be modernized, it needs to stay in its pristine or thought of pristine, you know, way of being. And anything to change it would be sullying it or adulterating it. It's just a distortion.
Yeah.
And that mindset is fundamentalism. And the greatest shock to me in my life as an astrologer is how much that exists within the field. Astrologers are far more conservative than I ever wildly imagined. And part of me can't even, you know, fathom it that like every other field, we're not going to make sensible adaptations. Here's one example. The charge-neutral distinction that I have been writing about for many years. 100% of people, when they review this idea, not one person has told me that this doesn't make perfect sense. But we didn't have the understanding of left and right hemispheres of the brain a couple thousand years ago, and so it wasn't part of astrology. And so a lot of people, even though there's, in my view, unanimous agreement that we could see the elements in this way, how many people are talking about it and bringing it in? I've been talking about it for 10 years. I've written about it in 4 different books, you know, which aren't that widely read, but that's okay. But it's not being integrated. And it's something that is common sense that everyone can agree with, and it's just a sensible modernization to see earth and air as neutral and water and fire as charged. Not one person has told me that this doesn't make sense, but how many people are integrating it? Because it doesn't gel with the tradition. So people would rather, you know, align with the tradition than to incorporate something as basic as left and right brain, which, you know, on the grand scheme of things is relatively new. Science and that understanding, you know, is just within the last couple hundred years. Astrology is a couple thousand years old. And so there's the issue of modernization.
Totally. Well, we're in it, and it's like Blasky pointed out at the blast, you know, astrology evolves too. And with the Uranus North Node conjunction in Pisces, we're bringing more mystical, awakened consciousness to it during this cycle, I guess.
I hope. And so my view is around the modernization. I was looking at the transits the other day, Kelly, and this whole idea of being in a progressive time. Here's what I saw, is that we're in the Uranus Pluto square now and using an 8-degree orb that separates around 2019. Then you have Jupiter Saturn conjunct Pluto in Capricorn, And then you have Jupiter-Saturn conjunction in Aquarius in 2020. And then in the 2020s, Pluto itself goes into Aquarius, and it'll be there for almost 20 years. And then after that, as soon as that ends, you have a Uranus-Pluto opposition. Right now it's a square, but after Pluto's done in Aquarius, Pluto moves to early Pisces, and Uranus goes to Virgo at that point, and you have a Uranus-Pluto opposition. Basically, what I'm saying is for now, for the rest of our lives, until we are old men, we're going to have one progressive event after another continuously. So my view is I don't get too worried about today at this point, because the way that I see the timeline of astrology events is that this is just a century of rapid modernization. And my view is that these tides are so strong, and these young people who are coming up in age, everyone younger than me has one of the outer planets and the signs from Sagittarius to Pisces. They're much more attuned to the transpersonal than anyone older than me. So as each day and year goes by, more young people who are focused or interested in the transpersonal are just going to be coming of age. And totally. So to me, it's inevitable.
Totally.
And so in the big picture, I'm not even that concerned about it, is I do think astrology is going to wildly modernize and adapt in the 21st century. It's just a matter of it playing out.
Totally, and it's people like us who are taking responsibility for it on some level, by the way we practice, by the books we write, by the lectures we do, to have that kind of focus that's going to help turn the ship around in a sense. Because like when I went to the philosophy group here in Boulder, at first I didn't really want to talk about astrology because I could tell they were kind of one of these Wilbur kind of consciousness, you know, core transformation, you know, whatever the methodology, they were very Buddhist, you know, they had a very strong focus on spirituality. But I quickly ascertained that they would probably laugh astrology right off the table. But then about a month into it, I started talking about it, you know. And some of them were into it, but a lot of them resisted it strongly, just as I felt, you know. And I challenged them on it. I said, have you ever had your chart done? And they're like, no. And I was like, well, then how do you have an opinion on it then? I said, let's sit down and do your chart. So I did a free chart for the people that were most resistant, you know. And it blew their minds. It blew their minds. They were so amazed by what we have in astrology. Now they're all like printing out my symbolism sheets and looking at their charts and wanting to understand it deeper because they see that how authentic it is and how life-changing it is and how it can help them in their evolutionary process. So I think there's a gap in society between what astrology actually is and what people think it is, and that's what's keeping them away from it, you know?
Well, sure. I mean, my own experience with astrology really reflects more of the collective kind of experience, because when I was young, I thought, you know, there was something to it. I remember when I was a child, I was intrigued by astrology, and I was fascinated, and I'm talking pretty young. And then I saw the caricature that astrology was, with sun sign stuff and the simplifications and some of the things that it was saying, and the this means that, like we talked about earlier, and the predictive qualities. And I thought astrology was a joke, and I went away from it, and I became a passionate skeptic. And then in my early 20s, I had a series of experiences. Pluto was hitting my Jupiter in my early 20s, and I started to wake up and review things and to see that there was a broader reality than my skeptical kind of mind was capable of understanding. And I opened up, and then I shortly after that, in my mid-20s, I returned to astrology with a more, you know, awakened or just aware kind of disposition. I was, you know, further along in my evolution at that point. And then I saw that astrology can be different than the way it was packaged and marketed, you know. But a lot of people went through that process of seeing, you know, being intrigued by it, but then seeing the facets of it that are dumbed down and simplified and way too, you know, almost childlike about the way that astrology is marketed and packaged, that rightfully so, there needs to be some individuation away from that.
Yeah. Well, I like, you know, when you talked about the level 8 stage and Wilbur's deity mysticism with the whole interior luminosities and sounds and archetypal forms and patterns. I think that's the level I've been working at with these expansive, effective states of love and compassion and leading toward that causal, formless mysticism of total emptiness. Because I remember in sixth grade, I was already having like a sense of connection with through Star Wars with the idea of the Force, you know, this sort of impersonal emptiness that is the force, that is the source of everything, you know. So that's why I kind of gravitated towards Taoism in a sense, because it fulfilled my Star Wars quota of my desire for an impersonal relationship with God. But I think that,
yeah, just to flesh out for people listening about these different stages, I mean, basically, level 5 is more of a world-centric view. Level 4 is like a more just an ego-centric thing that's projected on the world. Level 5 is like a world-centric view that, you know, that your vantage point is not necessarily any worse than mine, that we're all in this together. Level 6 is the centaur stage, which correlates with Chiron, and there's an integration of the body-mind system, and level 6 is the ability to first see the whole physicality as a tool for spiritual awareness. Then level 7 is a transpersonal stage where we are the realization that we're interacting with our own consciousness within everything, that we're the identity is no longer confined within separation consciousness, that you identify as things beyond your own skin. And then level 8, as you're speaking about, is this deeper immersion into deeper and higher levels of consciousness, things that you can't even talk about it because it's transpersonal, it transcends language. It's what happens in dreams and shamanic states, and what have you. And so, the issue though with level 8 is that some people like to go into such experiences, but from the ego, you know, ooh, I want to, you know, drink ayahuasca and do that, and that would be really cool or something like that. And so the ego sets up all these traps where you think that you're doing these levels, but you're actually still operating from some kind of egoic need to have an identity as someone spiritual, or do you think that this will be something cool to experience? That's all ego.
Yeah.
And so a lot of level 8 is immersing yourself in the dreamscape, let's call it, from a non-egoic place.
But not being ripped apart in some Dionysian sense, like you said.
Mm-hmm. And then level 9, the way Wilbur discusses it, is just residing completely as in awareness, as sourced energy, pretty much awakening fully into the sun. And the sun does have, you know, solar, just enlightenment is a solar word. And I'm not there yet. I have no idea, really. I just understand it conceptually. But level 9, I guess, will correlate with enlightenment and fully realizing the sun. Just you are awareness. You are not form at all. You just abide with what is. It's not about positive experience. It's not about bliss. It's just about being with what is. Completely and identifying completely as energy has a lot to do with level 9. And so yes, these levels of consciousness are very instructive to see our own personal evolution. And so as an evolutionary astrologer, I do understand the development of consciousness through there. And so we can understand where a client is at. Most clients are at level 4 through 6. That's where most people just are. They're either in the domination mentality, kind of Mitt Romney consciousness of level 4, or the democratic, you know, we're all in this together, which is level 5, or level 6, which is the beginning of awakening from all of that and beginning to transcend the limitations of just identifying within separation is the critical step of level 6. That's where most people are at. Is 4, 5, or 6 in my understanding.
Yeah.
And so knowing that and encouraging the movement, you know, through those levels. And astrology, this is what I talk about in the book, is a very clear depiction of the domination consciousness of level 4. You're the king in the center. Here's your empire that you want to secure. And here's the types of events that are going to help you succeed to secure your empire and be the king. That's level 4. And astrology, the conventional paradigm, is basically that level of consciousness.
Yeah, and usually to have a kingdom, you need lots of slaves to work for it.
That's the shadow side, is that we have hierarchies. That's the you know, very typical pattern of level four consciousness is the erection of hierarchies, and that's what patriarchy is about. If you're not white and male and heterosexual and Christian and older and wealthy, then you don't have any, you have less points on the hierarchical pecking order, and we're awakening from hierarchies and judgments of people and where they're at, because that is the shadow, that is the problem of this level of consciousness, is this patriarchal kind of organization around power and you know, getting points around domination. And that's what we see a lot of. I mean, astrology is a reflection of society,
yeah,
of our consciousness. And in society, that level of consciousness is very alive and thriving, and it always has been. And in my view, whether or not people want to throw stones at me or not, the Republican Party, in my view, is a very, very clear example of that level of consciousness, with, you know, the plutocracy of rewarding wealth, of much more
funding wars.
Yeah, wars about domination, about conquest, and about money, and that's level four consciousness is, and they don't like, level four doesn't like to admit its limitations, and it sees everything as a threat, and
yeah,
and those who hear you and I talking, you know, the response from that level of consciousness is to see anything else as being airy fairy and not of the real world and silly and all speculative. You know, let's deal with the real world, please, is the reaction from level four.
Mm.
You know, people want bread on their table. They don't want this stuff about spiritual evolution, so get real. That's the way level four views evolution of consciousness.
And our response to them is that the real world is made of energy and you can shape it with consciousness.
Yeah, and then if there is an antagonism with that level of consciousness, then it shows that you're not beyond that consciousness, that you yourself are embroiled in that, if there is a lot of issues with it or fighting with it. And so so my sense is to just have compassion for it, is to just allow it to be as it is, just like you allow, you know, a five-year-old to be in a very egoic way. It's just part of development. There's nothing wrong with level four consciousness. And so to accept it completely is the way to work with it, not to fight it.
Totally.
But just to have compassion and love for it, actually.
Yeah. Not
take it personally when it becomes, you know, attacking, because it's very secure, it's very preoccupied with its own domination and its own survival.
Yeah.
And so to not take it personally when it becomes, you know, having a temper tantrum.
Totally, yeah. I go play Scrabble with my dad, and, you know, he's old school from the Deep South, so there's, like, ingrained subtle racism in there, you know, against Obama, and he listens to Rush Limbaugh and all that. But I go over there, we play Scrabble, we watch a football game, and I just love him because he's my dad and because he's cool, you know. And like, I tell him, I say, you know, I agree that the government shouldn't always have to support people, but there's also people that need help and that need, you know, food to live. And I don't think we should just leave everybody behind. And, you know, we have these discussions, but from a place of like compassion, you know, and it's pretty,
yeah, I mean, do you think that Obama loses sleep over what Rush Limbaugh says about him? No, of course not.
Exactly, exactly. But they get all enraged, you know.
And so this goes into becoming a Uranian. You and I are Uranians. We've got Uranus and major aspect to our suns. And part of the being a Uranian is to move beyond that Saturnian hierarchical way and not take it at all personally.
Yeah.
Because the Saturnian hierarchical way is going to look at things Uranian very negatively, very disruptive, and try to shoot it down.
Yeah.
And the Uranian's job is to not resist that, to allow that, but to not take it personally and see it as part of what needs to play out in evolution. And so, you know, this is my own personal work I'll share, was that my karma was very afraid of the criticism and the antagonism. So I've always conducted myself by shielding my truth, because I'm afraid of, this is the Leo moon, of people not liking me. And the more that I have become a Uranian, the more liberated I am to say, hey, if people want to tear apart my ideas and my work, please do, you know, because it stirs debate.
Yeah.
And it disturbs critical thinking, and it gets people on these topics. So I actually welcome at this point, you know, people who disagree with me or don't like what I have to say, because it gets discussion about it, and I don't need to take it personally. You know, there might be things that I need to look at that they point out. Absolutely, I'll do that. You know, thanks for showing me where I didn't get something. You know, it's terrific. And so I welcome, you know, and I think Uranus does in general, welcomes the integration into the Saturnian world and all of how that needs to take form. But it doesn't take things personally. That's the awakening, the liberation of Uranus, is that to understand that this is about evolution. It isn't personal.
So do you have liberty to talk about the transpersonal astrology book that we're all participating in, or is that something for the future?
Why not? I don't think Armand and Andrew will mind. Sure, maybe we'll address that and then we can wrap up. I believe that at this time, at the Uranus-Pluto square, we are at the time of a movement towards the transpersonal. That's what this is about. Uranus in Aries is about new directions. And so my view is that the transpersonal has not been successfully integrated into the astrology system. I believe the work of Dean Woodjar and others was pointing us in that direction. But then, you know, Saturn castrated Uranus, and the field of astrology has really resisted a lot of that in the more conventional agreed-upon paradigm. And so this project that Andrew Smith and Armand Diaz and I are spearheading is to invite a bunch of astrologers, and it's mainly people of our age, you and I, a couple of people who are older, but most of the people are around the 30s and 40s, and a whole collection of different essays from different authors. We have 18 authors that are involved with this that are all going to contribute a chapter on how astrology can integrate with the transpersonal in different ways. And so, you know, you're a part of it, and many others of our generation. I don't want to drop any names here.
Yeah.
But
it's exciting. I'm excited to see what the final format looks like, because you get all these different perspectives and amazing blends, and it's just going to be a beautiful, like a great smoothie of transpersonal astrology.
Yeah, and this is where I see the field going, and then like we said before, the young people is where it's at, because they're the ones who have more of the transpersonal orientation and attunement, and this has increasingly become my focus, is on the generations that are coming up. So I'm now affiliated with the Evolver Network, and I'm actually doing a class on Sunday through Evolver, which is mainly young people who are interested in the transpersonal, and other types of venues is where I'm going. So, you know, of course I still want to have participation in the astrology world, and I have a lot of that going on as well, but bridging beyond the astrology world to where young people are and what they're into and things that are more transpersonal is where we can form these bridges. And that's very exciting to me.
Totally. That's one reason I'm back in Boulder, you know, to create this Academy of Metaphysics and Astrology. I put metaphysics first because it's that unity consciousness that comes from the metaphysical perspective of the transcendent that is, you know, astrology just comes out of that, you know, so it's like, We're both working with the new generations and saying, hey, let's wake up all together and have fun.
So, you know, being with the Aquarius North Node that you and I have, you know, there is a sense of the future. You know, where are things going? How are things evolving? That's what we're about. And other people might have more of a Capricorn attunement, and that's fine. As I said at the top, that has its own relevance as well. And that archetype is just as meaningful and valuable and necessary. But the issue is historically the castration, the mythic castration, and the healing of that, the integration of Uranus with Saturn, with Aquarius and Capricorn, is what I believe the Uranus-Pluto square is about, Pluto and Capricorn and Uranus squaring it. That is the theme here. How do we do that? And that's my prayer, is that we can successfully form these bridges. And so the transpersonal astrology book is largely a gesture in that direction.
So that will be coming out sometime next year, but the Astrology of Awakening is out now. And Eric, where can people get your new book? At soulvisionconsulting.com or?
That's right. Yeah. I encourage people to, if they're interested, you know, come to my website and, you know, that's where you can get it. I'll sign it. And the author actually makes some money if you buy it from a self-published author. If you buy it from other places online, the way that it's organized is that you're really supporting the huge, you know, billionaire, companies. And so, you know, it's a gesture of supporting, you know, the creator of these works. So I encourage people to come in and buy it from Soul Vision Consulting and, cool. Yeah, that's where you can find it.
Excellent. Well, I'll put this up and, any final thoughts before we go?
No, it's always a joy talking with you, Kelly, because we've known each other for some time now, and I realized that the interview went quite long, so if people are still listening, thank you for hanging in there with this pretty long interview. It's been a lot of fun, and, you know, just Kelly and I both have some Gemini in our charts, so thanks for hanging in there. So I just wanted to mention that. I appreciate the attention.
Oh yeah, yeah. We have we've gone on for 2 hours and 4 minutes, and I'm sure we could talk for like 12 hours.
I'm sure we have in the past, and you know, to be continued. So it's exciting to you know, share this with you and to be allies. So much appreciation for this, Kelly.
You too, man. Thank you.
Bye.